see and listen to, in remember and accept.
I vow to face the truth of the Tathagata's words.
The full moon is not to be seen tonight, but we know it's there. At least we've heard it's there. There's a kind of faint glow over in the east. And it's very still and quiet without that intense brightness. Very peaceful, looking for the moon and not finding it. I wanted to bring up some aspects of meditation practice, but I'm curious how many people here have what they would consider a kind of regular sitting meditation practice, regular, let's say, once a week or more. Then I feel okay talking about meditation. And for those who don't, maybe this could be encouraging. And for those who do, I think it's always possible to keep clarifying more and more what meditation practice is. Endlessly deepening our understanding and expression of what the of what this sitting is. So, in early teachings of the Buddha and late teachings of the Buddha, sitting meditation practice was described as having these two aspects. The kind of calming, settling, concentrated side of the meditation, sometimes called shamatha. Shamatha literally means calm abiding. And then wisdom, insight, vision, understanding side called vipassana, which literally means like higher insight, and that there's these two sides to the practice, and either one on its own isn't really complete meditation practice or isn't completely liberating. If the practice is just the calming, settling, concentrated side, very peaceful, like an eclipsed full moon, but maybe that's it, just peaceful while sitting there, relaxing and great stress reduction practice and so on, but not ultimately liberating, freeing from the problems and stress and suffering of our life, especially after the period of settling ends and things get busy again, then sometimes it might even seem like it was useless. without this kind of understanding side, insight side. And the insight side, the understanding or wisdom of how things are in and of itself, kind of a maybe an intellectual understanding of how things are, or some feeling, deep feeling of how things are, still without this, without being united with this calm, settled, physical embodiment in stillness and deep, focused, one-pointed concentration on the nature of reality, then it might just be another idea that, again, doesn't, when difficulties really come, it maybe not, might not be of so much help. I think both sides of, on their own can be definitely and almost inevitably are of some help, but the real complete picture is when these are united. Shamatha, the calming, settling, vipassana, insight, seeing. And the Buddha taught this way in the early sutras of the Pali Canon and also in the Mahayana, the great vehicle. And in the Mahayana sutra that unlocks the mysteries, the sutra of unraveling the mysteries, the Bodhisattva Maitreya comes to the Buddha and asks, Bhagavan, abiding in what and depending on what do bodhisattvas in the great vehicle, in the Mahayana, cultivate shamatha and vipassana? Abiding in what and depending on what do they practice this settling, calming meditation and this insight meditation? Another translation of these terms that the Chinese use is stopping and seeing. The aspect of stopping the mind, and then with a stopped mind, turning it to see. Abiding in what and depending on what the bodhisattvas in the great vehicle practice stopping and seeing. And the Buddha says to Maitreya, abiding in and depending on the unwavering resolution to teach the Dharma for the benefit of all beings and to realize unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment, do bodhisattvas in the great vehicle practice stopping and seeing. That's kind of a surprising answer when I first heard that. You think?
Could you say it
again? Abiding in and depending upon the unwavering resolution to teach the Dharma for the benefit of all beings. I'm like paraphrasing a little bit the sutra. And to realize complete perfect enlightenment, depending on this unwavering resolution for these two things, they practice these two aspects of meditation. I would maybe think, they practice them to just fully manifest meditation practice or something, but it's a very vast answer, right? It's a little bit intimidating to hear such an answer. If we wish to practice Zazen, can we open to this possibility of a resolution, and maybe eventually an unwavering resolution, like not the kind of resolution that comes and goes, to teach the Dharma? This was the part that was kind of unusual too, is you wouldn't think that they would cultivate shamatha and vipassana to teach the Dharma. They would do it for maybe to realize complete awakening, but but this resolution to help completely free all beings through the Dharma, which is how the Buddha frees beings from suffering. And they kind of go together in order to really completely, fully guide all beings to complete liberation through the Dharma. One would maybe have to do that completely, one would have to realize complete awakening, right? And that this would be accomplished through stopping and seeing of the mind. So it's also this abiding in and depending upon, we could say, great compassion. Great compassion is the unwavering resolve to teach the Dharma, to liberate all beings. Actually, literally in the sutra, it doesn't even say to free all beings. It just says to teach the Dharma. But I think that's the point of the Dharma. And to realize complete awakening is the wisdom side, you could say. So compassion and wisdom, depending upon this resolve to fully manifest compassion and wisdom. Bodhisattvas in the great vehicle practice this two aspects of meditation. Like two wheels on a cart, or the two wings of a bird, in order to fly or to roll, both are needed. Stopping and seeing. So really, there's meditation can't really, in the end, be broken down into these different aspects like this. But in order to talk about it, the Buddha was willing to do this, to say that there's these two sides, as a kind of provisional teaching in order to help approach what can't be broken into parts. The Buddha presented two parts in his early teachings and great vehicle teachings. Then, many centuries after the Buddha, after the Buddha Dharma was flourishing in China, what we now call the Zen house arose due to myriad mysterious causes and conditions. People like Bodhidharma walked from India to China, and when he got there, he didn't do anything. And later that came to be called the birth of the Zen school. And then there was, after Bodhidharma, the first ancestor in China, came the second ancestor. And then there was the third ancestor. And meeting the third ancestor was the fourth ancestor. And finding the fourth was the fifth. And then there was the sixth ancestor. But before he was the sixth ancestor, he was an ordinary woodcutter helping to support his mother by cutting wood and selling it in the marketplace. And one day he was in a busy marketplace, and maybe at this point he'd heard about the Buddha Dharma because it was all over China, but he wasn't like a practitioner. He wasn't a meditator. He wasn't a stopper and seer. But he was wandering through the marketplace with a stack of firewood on his back, and he heard somebody reciting a sutra, which it's not clear why they were doing this in the marketplace, but all kinds of things were happening in the marketplace, right, including sutra reciting, and it was the Diamond Sutra. And he happened to be walking by right during this section of the sutra that says a bodhisattva in the great vehicle should give rise to the mind of no abode. And it seems that the whole universe conspired to have this this woodcutter walking by that person in the marketplace, hearing that line of the sutra at that time. And when he heard that, stopping and seeing manifested in the sixth, what was a person who later came to be called the sixth ancestor. We could say his mind stopped. With no abiding place. And saw that no abiding place. The stopped mind saw itself, we could say. And the stopped mind saw that the mind's deepest nature is always stopped. And to me it seems significant that this stopping became clear for this woodcutter in the midst of a busy, noisy marketplace is where he realized this for the first time. Maybe not so commonly. Maybe people first it would be like in deep meditation, the mind starts to slow down and stop, and then one sees it. But I picture like all these like chickens running around and stuff, and people yelling and haggling over prices, and all kinds of chaos in this, you know, Chinese village marketplace in a kind of a big city actually in China. The mind stopped, and he saw, and his life was no longer the same after this. And he was selling firewood to take care of his mother. His father had died, and to support his mother, he would sell firewood. So he somehow made arrangements to sell all the rest of his firewood to cover the support of his mother for the rest of her life, and went towards the mountains to look for someone to share his stopping and seeing with. And he might have found various people along the way, but somehow eventually he ended up at the fifth Zen ancestor in the remote mountains, and was put to work pounding the rice in the back shed at the fifth ancestor's monastery. And to make a long story short, he eventually came to be the sixth ancestor. You can read the details in the Platform Sutra, which was one of the first Zen texts in China. So very important. In a way, you could say this, even though he was the sixth ancestor, it's kind of like the Chan or Zen school really was born with the sixth ancestor in China because of this writing. There were a few short poems before this, but this was like the first real presentation of Zen teaching in China was this writing of the sixth ancestor. And one of the key things that he said was referring to these two aspects of meditation. He used the terms, instead of shamatha and vipassana, he used the similar terms samadhi and prajna, which I would say virtually the same. Samadhi is more literally like the one-pointedness of mind, the deeply concentrated mind of meditation. And prajna is wisdom, or very similar to vipassana, or insight. So again, these two sides, almost same, different words for almost same thing, two key aspects of the whole path of practice. Samadhi and prajna, concentration, or one-pointedness and wisdom. And they were also presented by the Buddha as this, generally it's like you practice samadhi, and then in the depth of concentration, wisdom is revealed. But the sixth ancestor said something new, and this was the, you could say, what he said, the new teaching that he brought forth was the kind of trademark defining way of speaking in the Zen school. At least one of them was this. He said something like, good friends, please know that this one-pointedness of mind and wisdom are not two different practices. Or they're not two. Never say that they're not the same. This was something new in China and new in the world. The Buddha kind of seemed to imply that there were these two different practices and talked about them differently. But the sixth ancestor said, these are not two practices. They're like a flame, candle flame, and its light. So the candle flame is like samadhi, one-pointedness of mind, and its light is like wisdom, or prajna. The wisdom is the function of one-pointedness. The flame is the function of the light is the function of the flame. And the flame is the substance of the light. One-pointedness is the substance of wisdom, and wisdom is the function of one-pointedness. So there are these function and substance aspects, but one practice. Helpful to look at, I think, is that one-pointedness is the substance of wisdom. Right? Maybe even this, you could say like the essence of wisdom, or the what wisdom actually is this one-pointedness, one-pointed concentration. But literally, it's the one-pointedness of the mind and its object. Is what samadhi is defined even in the early teachings of the Buddha. We could say when meditating, it's the mind that's focused on the meditation object. The object might be like the breath. The mind is focused on the breath. When the mind and the breath become one point, that's samadhi. When it's not like, okay, here's me, like following my breath. You know, it's like that at the beginning of following the breath. But deeper and deeper until there's no distinguishing between me and the breath. It's just very peaceful realm of one-pointedness. And so, and this one-pointedness of the mind and its object, which may be the breath, or actually in all kinds of different realms, the mind and mental objects, for example, like I have a mental object of like this zendo, so the mind and the zendo, when they're one point, when there's no duality between the subject and the object, between the thinking mind and the thought of, that's in meditation, it's called samadhi. And also relatedly in kind of Abhidharma classifications of like aspects of every state of mind, they say, in these sort of psychological, analytical texts, they say one factor that's present in every state of mind is samadhi. And so they're not referring to every state of mind is deeply concentrated in meditation, because obviously it's not, right? But that actually there is this aspect of the mind and its object being one point. That actually, that fact is true in every state of mind. Even very busy, chaotic, distressed states of mind are actually one-pointed. Right? It's just that we're not sort of in tune with that or in touch with that. But that's according to definition. So linking together these different presentations, when the sixth ancestor says that samadhi, one-pointedness, is the substance of wisdom, this could be interpreted as that the mind and its object being one point, which is always the case of every state of mind, to see that fact, that's wisdom. Can you follow that? Right. So the seeing that the mind and its objects that are thinking perception, our mental apparatus, and this zendo in this room, and whatever we're thinking of or perceiving, are actually not separate. That they meet at one point. Even to say that they meet is a little bit off, because meet implies two things. So there's just one point, and that is the substance of what we call prajna. So the sixth ancestor didn't explain it all like that. He just said that the one point in this is the substance of wisdom. And wisdom is the function of this one point in this. So the way that it can manifest in the world, and the world of language and dharma, that can be taught and heard and so on. We could say that it's that kind of prajna, or the kind of even the just deep understanding in a conceptual way as well as a non-conceptual way, that this fact is so all the time, and without doubt this type of wisdom is the function of the one-pointedness. So, after all these centuries of shamatha and vipassana, these two sides, and samadhi and prajna, one usually leading to the other, suddenly they became inseparable. And this is Zen. And from then on, samadhi and prajna weren't mentioned so much in Zen, because of these two different aspects, and because they're not two, they didn't bother to bring them up so much. And they really didn't bring up very much shamatha and vipassana. Almost no Zen, classical Zen teachers use those terms at all. But still, almost in hidden form, these teachings continue to appear particularly in this, in our Soto lineage, a few generations before Dogen in Japan, there was a Chinese teacher who was a great reviver of the Sao Dong or the Soto school in China, Hong Zhi. And he, his kind of trademark way of talking about meditation was silent illumination, which was just his own untranslatable version of, you could say, same thing. These two sides, silence, stopping, stillness, nothing happening, and illumination. And the eclipsed full moon of peace, when the moon moves, the earth moves away, and the brightness illuminates everything. These two sides, like as they say, like a still mountain lake. And when it gets very still, then you can see into the water and you can see all what's going on in there. But if it's all stirred up on the surface, it can't be seen. So stop the wind, and then you can see. Or like gathering up some grass or weeds, maybe we could say, we're going to cut. So gather them up, gathering up and holding them in place. It's like the calming or the silence or the one-pointed focus, gathering together and holding, and then slicing it is the wisdom, the seeing, the function. And if we just try to like cut like that without gathering it up first, it kind of just bends the grass over, right? It doesn't really cut. We can gather together and carefully in one bunch, then very easy to just slice through. But if we just gather it together in one bunch and don't slice, then it's just a bunch of pressed grass. And so Zen sometimes gets criticized for falling into the silent stillness side, and sometimes neglecting the seeing side. So as meditators, if we're used to just following the breath, for example, just stilling the mind, concentrating on one point, maybe helpful to question what's happening here. That could be the seeing. In the midst of this following the breath, to actually start investigating, for example, who is following the breath, or what is this happening here, kind of giving up a little bit of the stillness in a way seems to be necessary, a little bit, be very serene and silent and still, and then within that, what is this? And actually, is this stillness the stillness that's always here in the middle of the busy marketplace also? We could ask in the middle of the busy marketplace, where is the silent stillness? And is it actually here? So out of great compassion and the wish to be totally free, and with all beings totally free, may we continue such practice. Are there questions or comments?
Well, I'm intrigued by the idea that all states of mind, I'm not exactly sure how you said it, but that there's samadhi, there's still point.
There's one point in this.
There's one point in this in all states of mind. So, I think that we often, in a quiet state of mind, it's easier to go, oh yeah, it's 1 point, oh, so nice. But of course, it's more of a challenge when it's not. And so I'm wanting to try out an example that happened today at work and see if I'm understanding maybe what you're saying. Ask you what you think. So definitely, I practice in the marketplace. It's one of my primary places. So today I was at a meeting with a group of school district administrators, and they've been trying to figure out how to guide reforming their really failing high schools in their district. They call it high school reform. And they've been having these meetings now for many, many months, and it's just chaotic. It is so chaotic. There's all these experts. Everybody has a different idea of what to do. The principals are resistant. The teachers are resistant. So we were sitting there today, and first there was this feeling of struggle about that. Like, we're supposed to know what we're doing. There's something wrong. But then at some point, somebody just said, there were just a few of us, but one of them said, you know what? The reason why it feels like we don't know what we're doing is because we don't know what we're doing. And the reason why it feels so kind of chaotic and out of control is because it's completely chaotic and out of control. Nobody knows how to do this. The whole country, their peers are grappling. Nobody knows what they're doing. And it was like this stillness. Oh my God, of course. It's crazy. Oh, a sigh of relief, you know? And then there's this whole different way to... Now what do we want to do? It's not so much about who's doing it wrong, or who's doing it right, what's the right thing to do, but more like, oh, here we are. And you're sort of like, you know, when you finally can go in a bad situation, oh, this is suffering, you know. Oh, we're failing. And it almost feels good.
That's almost like one-pointedness.
Yeah, it can feel good to finally, you know, hit bottom. So I'm thinking that, is that an example of... one-pointedness in all, even in chaotic not knowing?
It could be at least related. Hard to know if it's, you know, exactly that, but it seems something like, it's just like the way things are, I think it, because it's kind of, it's returning to this, the way things actually are. As opposed to looking more outwards and trying to fix the situation, there's some kind of like turning back, it seems like, at that point. Almost like the group was like self-reflecting of like, yeah, it's just, and even to see, another way to say it would be like, when chaos is just exactly chaos, that's very peaceful.
I think that was the experience that we all had, was we just all went, oh, this is what it feels like to be in chaos.
Yeah, so maybe something like one-pointedness, yeah. Maybe if it was completely, unified with one-pointedness, maybe everyone would just completely stop talking. And it would be like, or the meeting would just end. So maybe it was kind of mixed in. It was enough that it would just be like enough to really settle you and the group.
Well, it shifted the whole focus from grasping to being present with, and a different, it's like a different way of being in the world.
Yeah.
Can open.
Yeah.
We're not grasping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Grasping actually involves like the mind and its object being separate. We can almost say that's what grasping actually is. Is the mind projecting its object as separate, kind of losing track of the one-pointedness. And when it's kind of like that gap is closed, then it's just here. Yeah. Yeah, that must have been refreshing for in that meeting.
Well, it was. It's surprisingly so, because this is a group that I regularly come home and tell Jean, oh, I'm out of here. I don't want to do it anymore. I hate it. You know, they're stuck, and I don't want to be there. Nobody wants to be there. The person who's leading it doesn't want to be there. But, you know, it just felt different today. It just sort of went, oh.
Great. Yeah.
This question is kind of stirring for me. You said from the point that you gathered all the thoughts, and you said earlier that wisdom was the function of samadhi.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, who cuts?
Ah. That would be, who cuts?
Wisdom would have to cut itself.
Wisdom is like the knife, maybe, we could say. No one's actually doing the cutting, but it's the cutting itself is the wisdom.
So they're cutting themselves, and that's what Kathy's talking about.
Hmm.
Say more, what?
Nobody did it, and nobody cut it. All of these different voices released themselves, understood themselves, which is what I think you were talking about.
That
wisdom is the function of samadhi.
I mean, it's a metaphor, so we could say there's this gathering and there's a cutting, but actually the gathering too, I mean, who does the gathering? We could also say, and we could say, well, there's nobody that does it, or we can say actually everybody.
Everybody
does the gathering and everybody cuts. Everybody meaning like the really big everybody, like, like everybody that excludes nobody. All things come forward to gather, you know, and then all things come forward and cut. And so this is, you know, anyway, maybe a whole other sort of aspect of this discussion, but we could say that actually bodhisattvas aspiring to this stopping and seeing, can't do it actually. They can't do it themselves, right? Nobody can do this, this work, so. But when the aspiration arises to, and the unwavering resolution arises, then all things continue to help this practice, which they already are. And with our resolution to practice, we're open to the help that's already creating the practice. It's already the gathering and cutting is moment to moment actually happening. But that's how much without the aspiration to practice that, we think that it's this big burden that I have to do, and that's when we maybe can't even aspire to it because it's too much. Yeah, kanodoko. Do you know that term? Kanodoko. The inquiry and response. Come up together, you could say, or like the mystical communion. Sometimes they translate of all, particularly between sentient beings and Buddhas. That actually are. Aspiration is our little part for the benefit of all beings. I vow to give my life to stopping and seeing without turning back for any reason. You know? And that, we bring that forward, and then Buddha comes to meet that. Buddha being all beings in the really big all. Sense the universe meets that aspiration. It's like kanodoko.
Thank you for that wonderful exposition of the what of meditation. Can I ask you about the how a little bit? You spoke about you have to break the stillness a little bit. You spoke about following the breath, but I think you meant that as an example, not as...
Right. Many, many objects.
So what happens after I cross my legs and sit down here?
yeah, the way that this could play out could be many, many different ways that these two aspects could work together, but and it's quite, I think, very creative and unique to each person to find a way that that's really alive for them. So no special formula, and you know, if as a meditator, I'm sure you try different things, but basically, some aspect of because really the mind is very unruly and wild, right? So there is this aspect of, conventionally speaking, useful to actually stop. And currently my personal kind of favorite stopping kind of how, and just recently, you know, just this way of no particular object except the present moment, but like really radical present moment, like this very moment, which includes all experience, so all the senses, experiencing the world, but like, and if the slightest veering into the past and future, just gently letting that pass and just present, which is challenging, and of course, right? But and some people would say that description is, that's what Zen practice is, just total present awareness of what's happening. But I guess today I would say that I would call that more of this one-pointed side. And there, we could say that because it's not separate from wisdom, that wisdom is there, but there could be this other aspect of within that complete presence and experiencing of the world to actually like bring forth the question of like, well, it could be any question, like, what is this, you know, or who is doing this? And then we might say, who just asked that question, like you did? And that's the other side. And it might not even be so conceptual as to ask it in those words, but just that kind of, it's an emergence, a little bit of a emerging from the just present awareness. And it's slightly disturbing to the present awareness, which is why it's helpful to be very stably in it, but it's kind of like, yeah, activating the mind a little bit. Almost, you could say, conceptual mind. But if it goes too far that way, then we lose the presence and we're just off into like, that reminds me of da 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 da. And it's past and future land again. So I think, but to unite the whatever the object of meditation is, which might be objectless awareness of what's happening, but particularly to investigate that, or I should say this, as opposed to investigating like, let me think about the nature of a tree and like picture how a tree works or something. Sometimes some people might recommend this, but I think to particularly apply the questioning of what is happening to what's actually happening in the present moment. That point maybe seems obvious, but I think often doesn't get expressed when you, in these discourses about stopping and seeing. Often seeing sounds like this really kind of abstract thing about somewhere else, which it could be done maybe that way too, but I think maybe the Zen way would be the seeing is about what's happening, which is stoppedness. Therefore, wisdom is the function of one-pointedness. And one-pointedness is the substance of wisdom, almost like that's the content of the wisdom, or even object of conceptual meditation would be the one-pointedness of mind. So it's really all one practice. That's maybe more of what, according to you, I don't know if you'd say that was answered your question, but
maybe it wasn't how I wanted.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, what and how can't really be separated. So even if we're looking for some technique or anything like that, like what is that even? What is the breath?
Well, Luna's, we used to go to Jikoji Meditation Center for 5 day sessions. And it was in one of those that, I'll try not to get too spooky with meditation experience here, but I was thinking about your idea of in every state of mind there's that object mind unity.
Yes.
How did you say it?
Yeah, the one-pointedness of mind and object.
But, you know, for the first couple of days, I was just a quiet person carving out a quiet time, you know, in my life and out of the rest of the world to do this retreat at Jikoji, which, you know, I was just imagining this little postage stamp, you know, of real estate, and the rest of the world was in its chaos, and I was lucky enough to be able to do this quiet time. But, you know, at about the third day, or third or fourth day, it seems that everything is kind of resonating together, that even when I'm hearing the motorcycles zip by on the road in front, or the airplanes going over on the way to San Jose Airport, it just seems like we're all in this same vibration or same meditation, and it's not such a carved out experience.
Yeah, all one piece.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, at the fifth day when we're driving back down, of course, we're all carpooling because there's no parking. But, you know, you kind of lose that resonant vibration as you, you know, stop and get gas or stop, you know, and get dinner on the way home. And, you know, everybody's back in their kind of individual vibrations.
Mm-hmm.
But the experience for me in the longer retreats is that somehow you find that vibration that everyone is sharing.
And we could say it's the great benefit would be that we trust that more and more deeply, so that at the times when we forget it, that we don't maybe see it. And so we could say, well, seeing it's maybe not the most essential thing, but deeply trusting that it is so is more important, we could say, than seeing it. Trusting it is so when we don't see it, which is a whole other topic, I could say, but yeah. And I think of the term too, the one practice samadhi, which was another term actually used by the sixth ancestor. Practice one practice samadhi. You could say that's the samadhi, or the one-pointed concentration on that there is only one practice, that all the airplanes and so on are joining us in this one practice, and the samadhi of tuning into that realm of airplanes and dogs and mailboxes and all of it, practicing together. And then, we kind of feel that realm, and then we forget it, and we are not in touch with it. But there's a trust, because on some level, I think we all know this. We do deeply trust it, and it's kind of just opening our trust to so it can fully manifest in the world.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.